total of 15 children have died from malnutrition and dehydration at the Kamal Adwan Hospital. Yezen Al-Kafarni, 10 years old, was filmed by local journalists at the hospital a few days before his death, barely able to speak. Dalia Sultan is 6 months old and displaying severe signs of malnutrition and skeletal fragility. In recent weeks, her parents have been unable to find or afford milk, so they have been giving Dalia water, which is likely contaminated, and dates wrapped in cloth to latch on. In fear of losing the upcoming election in America, Biden has called for a ceasefire during this holy month, while engaging in the theatre of genocide by dropping a pitiful amount of aid from the sky. Netanyahu, seeing the crumbling support of the world for his genocidal, bloodthirsty actions and pressure from the US, has publicly agreed not to engage in what he calls military activities during Ramadan, but privately continued to give license to the IOF to kill, most notably in what is being called the Flower Massacre, where starved men, women and children were shot at from tanks while they awaited aid trucks to deliver life-saving flour. The pressure is at boiling point in the occupying entity, with high-ranking ministers and spokespeople resigning and protests breaking out within the Zionist regime, as well as all over the world. This has only continued as the occupation announced last week that it will curb access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site in Jerusalem, during the fasting month. But despite the unfathomable, inhumane conditions of this second Nakba by the Israeli entity, the noble people of Gaza continue to resist their oppressor and show the Ummah the true meaning of faith and trust in God during this holy month.
Sayyidina, if I can come back to you, Muslims, we can sometimes forget the spirit of Shahr Ramadan. And as I said earlier, when iftar time comes, we engage in gluttony and greed. But it's surely more important than ever this year, is it not, that Muslims, we rein ourselves back and remember those, like those in Gaza, who are being deliberately starved to death.
I think absolutely one of the key lessons of the holy month of Ramadan is that we're fasting, as obviously the verses of Quran that were quoted at the beginning of the program, to لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, so that you might become muttaqi, so that you might be conscious of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, being conscious of Him is both in the personal, but also in relation to other people. And of course, one of the reasons for fasting is for us to feel the reality that many people all around the world experience every single day in their lives. You know, we're experiencing this for a month where obviously we know that when our time comes, the food will be there on the table or on the sofra when it comes for the time for iftar. But of course, people all around the world, and particularly obviously in Gaza, but all around the world where they're experiencing high levels of you know, poverty and of starvation and so on and so forth, it's a time to contemplate when it comes to the time for iftar, that you know, am I really seeking the spirit of this holy month by having empathy for them? You know, one of the du'as that we make in the holy month of Sha'ban, which is the salawat that's taught by Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salatu wasalam, where he says that, oh Allah, give me the empathy for those people who have less in sustenance than me. Because, and this is something really interesting from the Imam alayhi salam, because he's saying that if I have empathy, then I will be more willing to help somebody to come out of their situation, or you know, help them to free themselves from that situation. But it's actually having that empathy and praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having that empathy that He has made or given me much more compared to other people. So I should have empathy for those people who do not have as much as I have. So at least at the time of iftar, time of suhoor, when I'm coming to eat, then I should pause and really you know, consider, what am I actually doing? Can I eat less and use that you know, that I'm eating or spending to help other people. You know, one of the things that we always say is that don't go shopping when you're fasting, because your eyes are bigger than your stomach. But also, you know, in terms of eating, you know, and the month of Ramadan, I always find shows us how little that I need and how much I'm actually eating throughout the year, because I don't really need to eat that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So can I cut that down
realize that we can sustain ourselves on much less. Absolutely. I've always thought that, but yet the minute Ramadan is over, we forget those lessons. Sister Medina, if I could draw some parallels, or ask you to draw some parallels between, you know, the fasting that the brothers and sisters in Palestine are going to engage in, because of course they're going to also be observing the holy month of Ramadan, and ourselves in the West.
So I mean, in terms of the fasting of the Palestinians, I'm not sure Islamically, like, if they're exempt or not, because obviously if you're going through people who are ill, breastfeeding mothers who are, you know, who are pregnant, or, you know, all these people are exempt from fasting. And if you're ill, any chronic illnesses, liver, kidney problems, cancer, serious issues, you're not going to be fasting. But also we have to think about, you know, mental health. You know, people, I'm not sure Islamically if it comes under exemption from fasting, but mental health is just as important as our physical health.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we have certain struggles, mental health struggles, then we might be exempt. So, I mean, they're going through trauma every day, trauma after trauma, and they're not obviously recovering from that. So I'm not sure, even if they had access to food, if they would be conscious of the timings of when they should be fasting. But I saw videos of you know, them still keeping up with their prayers, even when the bombs are going off. So they're conscious of their prayers and things like that. But us in the West, it's kind of, we should see ourselves as having a privilege to be able to fast, that privilege to know when we are going to break our fast. Just mentally knowing that, you know, we're going to break our fast at a certain time gives us the strength to carry through the day and then to take the benefits of fasting. From a naturopathic nutritionist perspective, we don't recommend fasting for anyone who is going through high stress situation or chronic stress. So we call it adrenal exhaustion. So anyone, you know, suffering from those kind of things, we wouldn't recommend fasting. We view it as something that should be done in a restful state, and it should be a relaxing sort of meditative detoxifying process that you're not going to be having a lot on. So people tend to do it on retreats and things like that, if you want to draw parallels between Muslims and people who do like intermittent fasting and things like that. So in that sense, we can understand that it's a privilege to be able to fast and to be able to take care of our bodies, which in our tradition, our bodies are an amana. That means they're a trust and we should take care of them. So we should be feeling that, you know, how great it is that I can fast and I can detox my body and I can bring it to the optimal level. Like when you fast, you're going to be like bringing your body to a better level than it was before, both spiritually, mentally and physically. Yeah. So,
And it's interesting because, you know, you mention we, especially those who live in, let's say, wealthier countries or at least countries where there's access to food, we know at the end of the day, like you said, when Maghrib comes, there will be some food for us to break our fast. But do you think that, I want to actually end on this because it's an important point, that Muslims, maybe, especially in the richer countries, have lost the spirit of Shahr Ramadan in this very hyper-materialistic era that we live in. Is there a danger of that?
Yeah, I agree. So, like materialistic in terms of access to food?
Access to food, the kind of, you know, we've seen in certain countries, even in the Middle East, where there's a lot of wealth, these very extravagant and lavish iftars that they have, so much food left over, and, you know, people eating themselves into a stupor, really, like almost into a food coma.
Yeah, I mean, that has been forever, you know, since I can remember, like, gluttony and iftar times, and it's around the social aspect, because Muslims don't have the alcohol, the the parties, right, this yeah, and that. Exactly. So they have the food. Yeah. So food is their toxin.
Yeah.
And ultimately Ramadan is saying to us, you need to let go of that toxin, and you need to, and today, more importantly, in the time we're living in, food is a toxin. It's the new tobacco. It's the new, you know, it's the new drug. Yeah. Like it's being processed. There's a whole industry that's not being regulated. So our food is actually a toxin. So we need to be really careful about, you know, what we're putting in our body. And Ramadan is a perfect time to reassess what we are eating. And so just like the Palestinians are being exposed to constant, you know, they're in an environment which is like now rife with disease. So disease is spreading because of hygiene, and there's toxins everywhere all around them. We have the privilege of choosing what goes on and in our bodies. Mm. So that's such a privilege. And so if we reflect on that, it will really motivate us to just, you know, view this month as such a pleasure and to get through it in that way.
Sister Medina, thank you so much for all the pearls of wisdom and the advice. Sayyid Zafar Abbas, thank you so much for all of your wonderful words of wisdom. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for today. I'd like to also thank you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition. Assalamu alaikum.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Salaamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So another question we have over here is that why is it important for a teenager to talk about their feelings? If you could expand on that.
Yes, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. It's for a variety of reasons that teenagers especially should discuss about their feelings, what they have. They shouldn't, you know, vent up what they feel so that they can let out in a bad way. For example, watching too many movies or going with some friends or going out and loitering, you know, in the park, or even sometimes bad habits for boys like smoking. Because they've vented inside themselves those feelings and they can't let out to anyone. So first of all, that communication gap shouldn't be there. So to have a healthy outlet of release is to talk about it. So sometimes it involves even talking about people. But you know, Islam allows that if you talk about people for the sake of the fact that you want to, you know, like resort yourself, you want to improve yourself, or you want to know where you went wrong, then you can mention those things, for example, to a person you can confide in. And there can be none better than a mother or a parent who understands these laws of Islam and knows that there is no, like, you know, backbiting done over it. It's just to make them feel where they went wrong.
True.
And probably if there was some solution to it. So this is the best and most healthy outlet to release the stress and the anxiety.
Yeah, and I think what you just said, like, stress is something that's really killing the youth right now. And a lot of them, like a lot of my friends said that because of all the stress that they are bottling up, it's really making them, you know, release it in the wrong ways. And they said they can't help it. But some of my friends became Muslims and they said after, you know, seeing how we have Allah and how we have Islam that kind of caters for all of this, they show this relationship that's supposed to be made between a family. They say that we never knew this, we never heard of this, and we feel like it's so strong in, especially in these Islam. Muslim communities, yeah. Which is so special.
It's all because of those laws that have integrated inside their countries that make them feel that they are so free now. True. They can even leave their homes, they can even complain in the courts. They don't know that this is such a healthy outlet, right?
Definitely.
So another reason why talking about feelings is necessary is, you know, when a person, a teenager especially, verbalize their feelings, they know it what is with clarity what they're feeling. Because it's not like a jumbled thing in your head. You know, sometimes like some things are going on in your life, but you don't know, you've mixed them all up. So when you want that communication to happen, a teenager will know themselves for clarity. What is it that they are facing at that point in time? They won't mix it up in their mind. And the mind is such a thing that, you know, so many things can get inside. True. At one go. But verbally, when you're expressing, it's just one thing at a time, right? So they themselves will know with clarity what they're facing, and then you can help them and get rid of the root cause and come to terms with those feelings and emotions that they're facing.
Definitely.
So this is why one reason that we have to emphasize this communication and emphasize for them to let out their feelings. It's very important, especially for a girl.
Definitely. So we're just going to pause briefly and resume in a moment.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about one of the questions that a parent had, which was, why is it important for a teenager to talk about their feelings? And you have said some very interesting points, some of which were, you know, if they bottle up too much, they end up, you know, falling astray, releasing it in the wrong places. And when you express verbally, it very much clears your mind, which is so important, especially for a youth.
That's right. Another of the reason is that parents could help as elders and guides to the teenagers for support and guidance, which the teenagers need most. And the teenagers, if they trust the parents, they would get the most support and guidance from parents more than even their peers and their age mates.
Definitely.
Friends would lend a help, like a listening ear. But would they be able to guide and support? Support is a very, you know, like a important thing in a teenager's life, that one who is like a backbone for you.
True.
Wanting you to go through that. As far as financial support is concerned, example, any support that, you know, one needs at that time in a crucial moment, friend would do it in a very limited way. But the parents are the best supporters. So to open up that conversation with the teenager and to let them out, to talk about it, is very important. That is the starting of it, so that you can support and guide the teenager and not let her, you know, go astray, go for guidance somewhere else. Or more so, sometimes even go to a psychiatrist, where you have to end up spending more when they get so much stress in the long run that they can't handle their own situation, it comes to a point in time that you have to take them to the psychiatrist, which is a big issue in every way. You have to combat with it. You have to come in terms with it. Whilst if you go and see, the mother is the best psychiatrist if she knows what she's doing. And she goes about it in the way that Islam says, you know, going about it in a very delicate, fruitful, compassionate manner.
Definitely.
To get positive results out of it.
And also, I feel, especially teenagers today, they don't like when you kind of attach yourself too much to them, or when they feel like, okay, everything I'm doing is being watched, or, you know, or so I feel like there has to be a very good balance over here where parents show that they really care, they really support, but it's not like they're coming in the way every time or they're going to be there all the time watching everything. So, you know, that balance.
So that, yeah, that respecting of their privacy is important.
Exactly.
At the same time, watching over is very important.
Yeah.
That why do they feel what they're feeling now? Why have they bottled up so much? So to create that atmosphere of, you know, like light atmosphere so that they can feel like talking is to make them happy first, in the first instance, to do what is good for them, to make them feel lighthearted, you know, that this is now maybe cooking their favorite meal, taking them out for a walk, buying something for them as a gift. So that will open them up through, like, what they would like or need. You know, they would feel that somebody loves me and they understand. And then they would, of course, naturally talk about their feelings.
Yeah.
And this is when one should guide and support them.
True. Even
tell
like
them very politely that this is what the consequence will be if this happens. Or guide them that, you know, like, or support them. For whatever they want to embark upon, support them.
Exactly. So let's just have a short break and we'll continue shortly.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about Islamic upbringing. And one of the questions that we were discussing was why it's important for teenagers to talk about their feelings. And you said one of the last points you mentioned was parents can be guides and supports, while you won't find that in everybody. Mostly parents can be that
the main support.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing is adolescents and teenagers sometimes can be very isolating. They can be very aloof and lonely. And sometimes we can misunderstand them also. So we should not misunderstand them. We should know that this is like a natural process of growing up. You know, that isolation and loneliness. We should respect them at the same time. And we should always offer that, you know, that kind of, you know, support and feeling that they, you know, you are ready for to hear them out. And also ensure that they are not alone in this experience.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, to feel that somebody is also sharing that thing, what you are going through right now, you are not alone in that experience. For example, a girl might fail her high school, you know, and she might not be able to go to the university, and she has to probably do one more year to go through the exams and everything. So a parent, if they're bold enough and they are also compassionate enough, they would say that even we went through this.
Yeah.
We didn't probably make it through, but we were still studious enough to do it the next few years. Or maybe we left a gap in between and we went through another thing. For example, studying something that we loved, not just studying at random. Anything that just, you know, suits the curriculum of the time.
Yeah.
No, whatever you love. And who said that, for example, as far as this is concerned, this discussion of passing your exam or something, who said that this is the only way to show your talent? There's so many people who fail exams, but they are so talented people. So we should, you know, like remind them that they are not alone in their experience. Be that whatever, illness. Illness is, so many people are suffering. Maybe a girl is maybe having epilepsy or something like that.
Yeah.
We should remind them that people are worse off than that, and people are still moving along. So this is not lecturing. This is remindance in a very cool way. so that the teenager can feel that, yeah, it's not only me. So, you know, just as you feel that you have some company, whatever you are sharing, and people are worse off than you, you feel a bit heartened. You feel a bit better.
Yeah, you feel like I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I'm not the only one who feels sad and who feels a sense of failure or who feels that they don't have friends. And there are so many people who pass along this kind of phases, but yet they come out as winners in the end.
Definitely. And I think, you know, Islam is so special that kind of constantly are getting reminded that we have a special goal to reach. And the more trials and tribulations we, you know, we go through, we suffer, there is something greater waiting for us over there. And although this is difficult to explain to teenagers, I just remember just knowing this concept in general was really helping me in my life. There was a time where I had to get, you know, a surgery done, and I felt like, you know, for a while life seemed so bleak. But just my mom would keep on reminding me about these kind of simple instances, not pushing it, and I would just feel at peace for a while that, you know, there is somebody over there watching over me, which knows my situation, knows my position, and I feel like that was very special.
Yeah, and that's like, lucky are those teenagers who have such parents like yours, inshallah. We pray that all teenagers have your kind of parents. In this day and age, you know, life is going on so fast and parents don't even have time, you know, sometimes for their children to express so much. And that's why parents, if they're home, they have time to reflect upon the problems of their children. Definitely. It's an ideal situation when the parents have more time for the children rather than outside, right?
Yeah, Hasan. Thank you so much. This was very fruitful, and thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next one. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu
July 12, 1983, Place Hosseinia Jamaran, Tehran. Subject, Spiritual Purification and Focus on Spirituality. The ultimate perfection of human beings has been to know that they are helpless to understand that they are incapable of worshipping Allah, the one who was at the head of the lineage of prophets and saints confesses that we have not understand you and it is right and have not worshipped you. And that too is right because worship is secondary to knowledge. This knowledge is to the extent of humans, to the amount that is the limit of humanity. They have knowledge and the biggest of them is the Honorable Prophet. However, knowledge of Allah is in excess of this amount, which is the limit of humans.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to talk about certain speeches and viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who was the great leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to take some points and lessons out of these speeches and viewpoints in order for us to make use of them in our daily lives. About the holy month of Ramadan, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "With the coming of the holy month of Ramadan, the month of mercy, forgiveness and blessings, I beseech God the Exalted to make all of the Muslims more aware of their duties and responsibilities that the Creator of the worlds have given them. The responsibility of preserving the divine laws and acting upon the Holy Quran, which is the foundation of the revival of the honor and grandeur of Islam and the Muslims." Well, here Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is talking about the greatness of the month of Ramadan and the spiritual progress that one can have in this month. The world's religious and spiritual leader highlighted the spiritual perspectives and depth of philosophy of divine fast during the holy month of Ramadan. The founder of the Islamic Republic maintained that the holy month of Ramadan is an opportunity for self-training and self-purification.
صلى الله عليه
صل
يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, following the teachings of our Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, also used to advise devotees to spiritually prepare themselves to observe the Night of Power or Laylatul Qadr, which has great virtues. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh used to attach great significance to the holy month of Ramadan and cancelled all extra activities to devote himself for divine and spiritual activities. The spiritual leader of the contemporary Muslim world used to spend the hours of this month to worship and mediate and considered the prayers as means of reaching to divine love. You see how this great character used to spend his time to worship God in this holy month, and he strongly advised the youth and people to do so, and that shows the significance of the mercy of Allah in this holy month. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Spring of the Truth. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our special guests, Dr. Mark Humphreys from Ireland-Israel Alliance, along with Hamza Tortsis from the Sapient Institute. Do you see, Mark had asked, do you see the impact that it's had on Jews?
Of course I do. I consider myself empathic. The impact it has had, of course, is going to be traumatic if that's how they perceive things. I'm not denying the impact, whether it's propaganda or not. So I do empathize from that perspective. But at the end of the day, I already said there's been five equivalent in October the 7th since 2008 from a numbers perspective, from killing innocent human beings, from killing Palestinians. Why the moral asymmetry? Why do you believe Israeli blood is worth more than Palestinian blood? Because you're not even bothered to address.
You're not even bothered to address
that reality. There are five equivalent October the 7th inflicted on the Palestinians before October the 7th.
You're talking, first of all,
just be honest, you don't care about Palestinian.
No, first, you don't care. What I want for Palestinians.
You're racist, right? Or ignorant, one of those
what
two.
What I want for Palestinians.
You want them to be impressed and you want them to respond to the oppression in the way that you want.
I've been clear my whole life. What I want for Palestinians is I want them to live in peace and prosperity.
Okay.
And for
stop
me,
the
hold
apartheid.
On, hold on. For me,
illegal occupations.
Hold on. For me, the fundamental thing that is stopping Palestinians and has been stopping them since before they were called Palestinians, which a name that emerged in the 60s.
That's not true.
Anyway. The thing that is stopping Palestinians from living in peace and prosperity is their own ideas. The ideas that are in their heads. Now, that makes this potentially...
Do you know the opinions, the whole of the Palestinians? You know all of the ideas?
Let me just try and make the point, which is, in some conflicts in the world, you just have to fight, you have to keep up the struggle. You have no chance at all. You're being brutalized by some neighboring dictator. The struggle is perhaps decimating your country, but if you give up the struggle, you'll just be decimated even more by the dictator, whatever. There are many, perhaps most wars in history are like that. You just have to fight whoever is up against you. The Israel war, I believe, is not and never has been like that. The war between Israel and the Arabs and then Israel and the Palestinians is a war where if the Palestinians modified their ideas, everybody could live in peace and prosperity. And it's harder to see on the West Bank, where there's no agreed definition of territory. It was unbelievably easy to see in Gaza from 2005 to 2023. All the Gazans had to do was stop, and they had a solution. It was right there waiting for them for 18 years, but they wouldn't take it. Instead, they wanted to continue the war. They fired rockets at Israel, which inevitably brought Israel back to attack Hamas, to do aerial bombing, because sending in troops on the ground means dead Israelis, so they did aerial bombing. They did send in troops. I've met some of the troops who went in on the ground, but very few went in until 2023.
Because they're cowards, that's why.
Well, that's why they wear nappies. Hold on. Calm. Right. First of all...
I am calm. I said they wear nappies. It's a fact.
First of all, if they go in on the ground, they die, right? Any troops that go in the ground die. But also, combat on the ground is also very dangerous for local civilians. They die as well, too. It just escalates.
So how does this actually present a case against... You've mentioned some untruths there, but how does this go against my presentation?
Well,
we've shown intent, and we've shown the actions that support the intent.
There's no intent.
There's no intent?
No, there's no intent.
The ministers, people of positions of power, we have over 100 statements, including the IDF, a general, the people of significant power, think tanks, having genocidal statements, and the dumb bombs, around 50% of the bombs are not even laser-guided, right, just to annihilate everything.
Okay, well, let me say a few things.
That's not genocide?
Okay, Hansa, let Mark just...
Let me say a few things at the core of it, right? I don't agree with statements talking about Amalekites and stuff like that. I understand anger and hurt and fury on the Israeli side. I mean, I can feel it, and I'm not Israeli. I can understand that anger, but I don't agree with Amalekite-type statements or anything like that. So what you have to look at is what's actually happening. Right. So what's actually happening compared to those statements? So, for example, one of the first things that happened was an announcement for civilians to get out.
I've already mentioned that.
Northern Gaza, right? And get into southern Gaza.
And then you just bomb when they're evacuating. You kill them when they're evacuating.
That's not what happened.
Aerial analysis has proven that.
We'll give the figures for which Euromed have given the Swiss monitoring group. And they have given the figures of almost 30,000 Palestinians killed. Now, to to go back to that point, the bombing of northern Gaza, how can it be said that it was precision bombing when there were that many civilians killed? I just want to get to the core of that. Do you believe that's just collateral damage? Or do the Israelis just believe that's collateral damage? Or how do we square that circle?
Okay, so Israel set itself the job of destroying a group that controls all of Gaza, essentially, Hamas. So it's an unbelievably ambitious job, which it has never attempted before, to take an entire territory and wipe out the militant terrorist group that's in charge of it. Now, probably every fact I say Hamza is going to challenge, but...
You're providing no citations, no evidence, nothing.
But Gaza north and south is... Gaza north and south is practically an armed camp in the sense that there's a tunnel system of several hundred kilometers. Presumably you agree that exists. The tunnel system is going underneath apartment blocks. It's going underneath mosques. They found openings to the tunnels in mosques, in schools, in private houses. There was a report there that the IDF said that every single mosque they had searched so far on the ground and every single school that they had searched on the ground had either weapons or a tunnel underneath it. Now, you may not believe any of this. I certainly believe that's true because that is the way Hamas would fight. It is the kind of morality that Hamas would believe in, the tactics that they would use. So it's an incredibly hard job to clear out Gaza, which is why they've started doing it sector by sector. They wanted to move the population down to the south. Now they're dropping leaflets. They've divided the south up into zones, and the leaflets are saying things like, here in this red sector, we are going to be, there's going to be fighting and bombing in this red sector today. Move along this road into these green sectors. So now, it's not very nice for people who live there to be told with a message from the enemy from the sky, get out of your house and you may never see it again, move down the road. But why are they doing this, is the point, if their aim is genocide? And show me any army that would do this in the history of the world.
But this is a red herring. This is totally irrelevant. The point
why
is...
Why are they doing it?
Okay, so
no, you
why would the
this?
Gazans believe the IDF when the IDF know? Have told them to move and when they've moved, they've been bombed?
They haven't bombed them.
They have. The error analysis has been shown by independent entities.
They bombed Hamas fighters.
No, they have. Well, women, children? Children?
They bombed.
Is a child a Hamas fighter? Is a child a Hamas fighter?
Well, if you're saying...
Are 11,000 children Hamas fighters?
Well, hold on.
It's genocidal language, dehumanizing language.
Are children fighting for Hamas?
Are children Hamas fighters?
By definition...
And are they guilty?
If we know...
Should they be bombed?
Hold on.
Should we kill children? Is that what you believe?
If we know nothing other than it's a child, then they're not a Hamas fighter. If they're under 10 years old, they're not a Hamas fighter. If they're over 10 years old, are over 10-year-olds being used by Hamas? Because I've seen plenty of evidence that they are. As spotters, as runners, as carriers of ammunition.
So basically, that language is basically blurring the boundary between a combatant and a non-combatant.
It's not language. I'm talking about what Hamas are doing.
So you're basically saying it's okay. Because of that, we should kill everybody. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if I was saying that, wouldn't I say it rather than you?
Well, I don't know. You've said a lot of things without any basis.
Rather than you having to say, oh, so you're saying just
look, let's think about your framing. This is very important. The way you're framing it as if there are two state actors that are fighting each other. It's not symmetrical. There's an asymmetry. When you're talking about Gaza that was left alone in 2005, it's still known under international law as an occupied territory. Secondly, they control even the daily calories. Academics have called it perverse, degrading, and unlivable in many places. So from that perspective, the way you're framing it as if there are two state actors and there's a war. It's not a war. In actual fact, Israel, under international law, has no right to defend itself. Why? Because it's already in
Israel has no right to defend itself.
Yeah, according to international law. Let me explain why.
So after 7th of October,
can I explain
Israel
why?
Should do nothing.
I'm not saying that. Listen to what I'm saying.
What should Israel do then?
They should stop the apartheid regime. They should stop the illegal settlements. They should stop oppressing the Palestinians. They should stop killing children. They should stop forcing imprisoning children. The list goes on and on and on. That's what they should do. You want peace? Don't don't be an oppressor. If you want priests, don't have apartheid. There are 65 laws that discriminate against Arab Israelis and Palestinians.
We're on to a new
Are you happy with apartheid?
We're on to a new topic every 2 seconds.
Are you happy with apartheid?
Hold on. My problem with
Sounds
this,
like it.
My problem with this debate is there's a new topic every 2 seconds.
You're not directly answering my questions. That's why.
Let Mark speak.
I think we ought to dig into some topics and go a bit slower. I'm happy to discuss all these topics, by the way, but a new topic every 2 seconds is a bit hard to cope with.
No, because I'm just challenging you.
We need to stick with the topic.
I'm challenging the misframing.
We need to stick to the topic with which the reasons why you're here. I think we need to stick that. So go ahead, Mark.
There's about 100 trucks a day going into in aid. Going into in food.
Not answering the question.
Hold on. Going into Gaza right now. The issue. Sorry, if we're back to the issue of genocidal intent. Well, the question is, why are these leaflets being dropped from the sky? Not just that, but phone calls as well. There's been several million text messages, many thousands of phone calls because they're much more human intensive. There are accounts from Gazans. One of them was the caretaker of an apartment block. He said Israelis were on the phone with him for 2 hours explaining who they were attacking, when, why his people had to get out of the apartment block and when it was safe to go back. Now, my point is not that absolutely everything Israel ever does in a war is going to be perfect and that can be justified. That wouldn't be true for any war in human history. People make errors and people get enthusiastic and people misidentify and people do commit crimes as well. But my point is that there are too many things that don't fit in with your simple claim that Israel just wants to kill everybody. And we start off with all the warnings.
No, I didn't actually say that. Genocide is
killing everyone in the territory.
No,
right?
But look, for example, you believe in the Armenian genocide, right? You believe that the Ottomans committed an Armenian genocide. Is that true?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
But I don't think we should talk about that.
No, I'm not saying that.
10 minutes.
No, but,
I
want to show your maybe inconsistent principles here, because there is no proof of intent for genocide there, yet you believe it's a genocide. Also, the other Armenians towards the east were untouched. So a genocide doesn't mean, even according to your own perspective...
At the risk of discussing it, they drove them all into the desert
You're missing the point, though. They want to drive the Gazans, and they've been starving the Gazans, too. I'm showing the inconsistency, because it's related to the point. It's about genocide. You believe in a genocide, but you can't prove intent of a genocide. The point is, you have an entity, the Gaza Strip, that the Israelis have full control over the water, the electricity, and the food, to the degree that they said there can be only this many calories per day, according to academics. So my point here is, how is that now an independent state, and your framing of that there is asymmetrical war going on?
Well, how come...
That's my point. So my point
How come before 2023, if Israel was so evil, they were providing electricity and water to Gaza? How come?
Well, yeah.
If they're so evil.
Yeah, but they were controlling it.
But if they're so evil, why didn't they just cut it off before 2023?
Well, wait, hold on a second.
They were providing electricity and water to Gaza.
Yeah, but if Gaza had its own... And that just proves my point. So you've actually proved my point, which is Gaza doesn't have control. Israel's providing water, electricity, Gaza doesn't have control. So how can they flourish when they don't have control?
Gaza before 2023, of course it didn't have full control of its own territory. I never claimed it did. What I claimed was that there was a route for them to peace, prosperity. For example, Israel was
providing... They
weren't occupied.
International law, Gaza is considered an occupied entity even post-2005.
Hold on. Israel...
Do you believe in international law?
Just not a new topic.
Yeah, but it's not a new topic. You're making a statement that's just making things up.
As I say, Hamza, it's a new topic every 2 seconds.
It's related, actually.
They are related, but let's spend a bit of time on the topic and then go on to the next one.
Sure.
What I'm saying is, that fighting an enemy like Hamas is unbelievably difficult.
No, but you're framing it. Okay, let me explain why this framing is all wrong. Number one, I said I want to justify the point I mentioned earlier. This is international law. According to valid interpretations of international law, Israel is already in an aggressive position because it's an illegal occupier. And by virtue of that, they have no right. The idea I have a right to defend myself is, well, you're already in aggressive stance, right? So therefore, they're in an aggressive posture. So, and from that perspective, legally, they have no right. Now, you could talk about the moral question, that's fine. But legally, they don't have any right to defend themselves because they're an illegal occupier. And you're just framing as it's just Hamas. Notwithstanding Hamas and Islamic Jihad, they're proscribed terrorist groups according to the United Kingdom. There are other factions within the resistance that are legal, and they're using the international right according to the Geneva Convention and international law to actually resist an occupying force. They're actually allowed to resist an occupying force. This is international law.
Yeah, look. I'll tell you what. Look,
yeah, what? Is it international law? Are you allowed to resist an occupying force?
Here's a question. Gaza is not occupied.
It is occupied.
It is now, right? No.
It is occupied. According to international law, because Israel had control of resources...
Gaza is going to be occupied now for decades.
Listen, this is rhetoric. Listen.
No, it's not rhetoric.
According to international law, notwithstanding the fact that the Israeli settlers left, illegal settlers, may I add, because Israel had control of the population to a degree, electricity, water, and so on and so forth, it's still considered as an occupied force according to international law. So you can't say it's not occupied because it's still considered occupied. This is why there is a resistance movement. This is why there are valid legal factions.
It's not why there's a resistance movement.
Of course there is. It's not just Hamas and Islamic Jihad. There are other factions that are trying to resist the occupier.
Gazans' issues since 2005... are all self-inflicted. What Gazans could have done was they could have chosen a different path after 2005. They could have said, well, our brothers in the West Bank can deal with their own lives. We're going to pursue our life here. There's a border, and that's the way...
So let's stay occupied, right?
Okay, guys, so in all that's been said, and to conclude... How do we now see, and I'm going to ask you first, Mark, how do we now see the two-state solution and how do we move forward?
Okay, I think the two-state solution is dead as a dodo at the moment. I say at the moment, the dodo is not coming back, but dead as a dodo probably for the next couple of decades. It was already in severe trouble in the Second Intifada. I think the Second Intifada really killed off the idea. The idea of a two-state solution is that some border could be agreed, that Israel would exist and some Palestinian state would exist, and that by doing that, by defining borders, there would be less war, not more war. Now, Israelis fundamentally now believe that any such border, no matter what it was, would lead to more war, would lead to horrific war. So let's say some deal was agreed and some Israeli government was stupid enough to sign up to it for some border on the West Bank, and maybe some settlements were kept and some were closed, and there's some border. The problem is most Israelis, I think, would now feel that that would be another Gaza, that then heavy weapons would be brought in, perhaps artillery, into the West Bank, rockets would be coming through 24/7, and everybody would be, all the terrorists and jihadists would be gathering in the West Bank for the final destruction, the final war to destroy Israel. It would be Gaza times 10. Gaza was a trial run for the two-state solution. It was a trial run. Gazans could have ignored Israel. They could have lived in peace and prosperity. They could have enjoyed their lives. They rejected that. And Palestinians of the West Bank would probably reject it too. So the two-state solution is dead. What happens now, nobody really knows. I had optimism before, not much optimism, but at least a bit, before 7th of October. I have no optimism now. I had a plan that could be followed that I believed in, and I think many Israeli people did, or pro-Israeli people. But I don't think we do know. I don't think Israel knows what it's going to do when it, if, and probably when, later this year, it actually destroys Hamas. It's not going to solve its problems on the northern border and the West Bank. It's going to lead to a whole load of new problems in Gaza. You know, are they going to be able to stop a new terrorist group taking over, maybe rebrand it? So I don't think Israel has some kind of answer as to what it's doing. What it, what Israel has is it's in absolute shock that Hamas was able to do this attack on the 7th of October. It's absolutely determined that Hamas will now no longer exist, except maybe in a hotel in Qatar. But it will no longer exist in Gaza. And as I think I said earlier, whatever we say, that's really its plan. But I'm afraid I've no hope really to bring. The only hope in this conflict, which I did mention earlier on, is that Palestinians change their ideas about the future and about what they want. But unfortunately, I really see almost no sign of that. And I see almost no sign that their allies, like Hamza, in their allies in the West and around the world, are even interested in getting them to do that. So I'm afraid there's nothing I can say. The problem can be easily solved if Palestinians decide we'll just compromise, we'll lose some of our territory, we'll have some kind of state, we'll live in peace. War with the Jews was a bad idea. We'll put it all behind us like Germans in the 1950s. But there's no sign of that happening. Maybe it'll happen among the Gazans. That could be the only possible thing. Maybe after the terrible loss of their war, that they'll be like Germans in the 1950s and they won't want to pursue the struggle anymore in 2025 going forward. But that's a tiny little crumb of hope. I'm afraid I've no hope to give you, I think.
Hamza?
Yeah, so it's interesting that we have othering language, which leads to dehumanization, and dehumanization leads to genocide. The Palestinians change the ideas, as if we know all of the ideas of the Muslim, Christian, Palestinians. The kind of othering that is happening in your language, and also the subtlety between war against Israel, now war against the Jews, is these subtleties, these kind of propaganda techniques, which are quite, in fact, quite devilish. I know you're an atheist, so don't take it personally because you don't believe in the devil. But the point is, it's a devilish ploy because it is well known that the Palestinians, Muslims as well in general, have never wanted to fight the Jews. In actual fact, Islam preserved the Jewish community. Philip Mansell's book, Constantinople, has a primary source of a Jewish rabbi that was expelled from Spain because of the Inquisition. He said, come to the land of the Turks, rich are the fruits of the earth, we live in peace and freedom. Amnon Cohen, a Jewish historian, he's got a book called World Within. It's a two-volume book. He collects 1,000 records of the judicial records, the Sigil records. And he concludes that although the Jews had the freedom to go to the rabbinical courts, the majority of them, or a substantial number of them, wanted to go to the Qadi, the Islamic judge, because the new justice lived under the Islamic principles. He even goes to the Manushai, and he says women would complain of nafaqa, meaning maintenance from their husband to the Islamic judge. And I could go on and on and on. Zion Zohar, you could talk about jihad. True jihad is liberation of people. Zion Zohar, another Jewish historian, he talks about the Iberian Peninsula. He says, thus, when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar in the Iberian Peninsula, the Jews saw the Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And if you look at the treaty of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace himself, he had a treaty with the Jews, with the Jewish tribes, and he said they should not be harmed, and they act as one body. This is unprecedented in history. We're not fighting the Jews, we're fighting Zionism. Our job is to take care of all human beings, to give them dignity, and that's extremely important. If you want peace, then don't have apartheid. You can never have, haven't we learned from South Africa? South Africa had to dismantle the apartheid state in order for peace to exist. You cannot have peace with injustice. You cannot have harmony with injustice. You cannot have peace with apartheid. So remove the apartheid system. Number two,
Stop illegally occupying someone else's land. Stop growing the settlements. For example, the academic Glenn E. Robinson in The Death of the Two-State Solution, Israel, the Palestinians, and the Arab World in the Age of Netanyahu says the following. The most important reason for the defeat of the Palestinian National State Building Project has been Israel's settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which have been strongly promoted by Netanyahu since 2009. The preclusion of any serious future withdrawal from the West Bank was the reason why the Likud party put the settlement project on steroids after its 1977 election victory. The Likud's settlement drive was designed to keep the West Bank under permanent Israeli control and had both political and strategic dimensions. The Israelis, the government, never wanted peace, and it's clear from their actions. Also, with regards to the two-state solutions, none of the two-state solutions were truly two-state solutions. It was always a subjugated Palestinian people, always. As Edward Said famously said, that it was an instrument of Palestinian surrender, a Palestinian Versailles. The Palestinians have in effect discounted the unilateral and international acknowledged claim to the West Bank and Gaza. And this, he was referring to the famous Oslo Accords that was basically, you know, famously, they thought this was a great achievement from the Israelis, but in actual fact, it was just further subjugating the Palestinian people, and they had to basically